found in her bedroom closet, on her washing, when she went to hang up her negligee. Jim made a tentative swipe under the bed. I looked over the foot to see if a snake would come out. None did. Jim made a deeper swipe. "Do snakes grunt?" "It ain't a snake," Jim said. "It's somebody." Suddenly, a filthy brown package shot from under the bed. Jim raised the broom and missed Dill's head by an inch when it appeared. "God Almighty!" Jim's voice was reverent. We watched Dill emerge by degrees. He was a tight fit. He stood up and eased his shoulders, turned his feet and their ankle sockets, rubbed the back of his neck. His circulation restored, he said, "Hey!" Jim petitioned God again. I was speechless. "I'm about to perish," said Dill. "Got anything to eat?" In a dream, I went to the kitchen. I brought him back some milk and half a pan of cornbread left over from supper. Dill devoured it, chewing with his front teeth, as was his custom. I finally found my voice. "How'd you get here?" "By an involved route." Refreshed by food, Dill recited this narrative. Having been bound in chains and left to die in the basement, there were basements in Meridian, by his new father, who disliked him, and secretly kept alive on raw field peas by a passing farmer who heard his cries for help, the good man poked a bushel pod by pod through the ventilator. Dill worked himself free by pulling the chains from the wall. Still in wrist manacles, he wandered 2 miles out of Meridian, where he discovered a small animal show and was immediately engaged to wash the camel. He traveled with the show all over Mississippi until his infallible sense of direction told him he was in Abbott County, Alabama, just across the river from Macomb. He walked the rest of the way. "How'd you get here?" asked Jim. He had taken $13 from his mother's purse, caught the 9 o'clock from Meridian, and got off at Macomb Junction. He had walked 10 or 11 of the 14 miles to Macomb, off the highway in the scrub bushes, lest the authorities be seeking him, and had ridden the remainder of the way clinging to the backboard of a cotton wagon. He had been under the bed for 2 hours, he thought. He had heard us in the dining room, and the clink of forks on plates nearly drove him crazy. He thought Jim and I would never go to bed. He had considered emerging and helping me beat Jim, as Jim had grown far taller, but he knew Mr. Finch would break it up soon, so he thought it best to stay where he was. He was worn out, dirty beyond belief, and home. "They must not know you're here," said Jim. "We'd know if they were looking for you." "Think they're still searching all the picture shows in Meridian," Dill grinned. "You ought to let your mother know where you are," said Jim. "You ought to let her know you're here." Dill's eyes flickered at Jim, and Jim looked at the floor. Then he rose and broke the remaining code of our childhood. He went out of the room and down the hall. "Atticus," his voice was distant, "can you come here a minute, sir?" Beneath its sweat-streaked dirt, Dill's face went white. I felt sick. Atticus was in the doorway. He came to the middle of the room and stood, with his hands in his pockets, looking down at Dill. I finally found my voice. "It's okay, Dill. When he wants you to know something, he tells you." Dill looked at me. "I mean, it's all right," I said. "You know he wouldn't bother you. You know you ain't scared of Atticus." "I'm not scared," Dill muttered. "Just hungry, I'll bet." Atticus's voice had its usual pleasant dryness. "Scout, we can do better than a pan of cold cornbread, can't we? You fill this fellow up, and when I get back, we'll see what we can see."
"Mr. Finch, don't tell Aunt Rachel. Don't make me go back, please, sir. I'll run off again."
"Whoa, son," said Atticus. Nobody's about to make you go anywhere but to bed pretty soon. I'm just going over to tell Miss Rachel you're here, and ask her if you could spend the night with us. You'd like that, wouldn't you? And for goodness sake, put some of the county back where it belongs. The soil erosion's bad enough as it is." Dill stared at my father's retreating figure.
"He's trying to be funny," I said. "He means take a bath."
"See there? I told you he wouldn't bother you." Jem was standing in a corner of the room, looking like the traitor he was. "Dill, I had to tell him," he said. "You can't run 300 miles off without your mother knowing." We left him without a word. Dill ate and ate and ate. He hadn't eaten since last night. He used all his money for a ticket, boarded the train as he had done many times, coolly chatted with the conductor, to whom Dill was a familiar sight. But he had not the nerve to invoke the rule on small children traveling a distance alone. If you've lost your money, the conductor will lend you enough for dinner, and your father will pay him back at the end of the line. Dill made his way through the leftovers and was reaching for a can of pork and beans in the pantry when Miss Rachel's "Dude Jesus!" went off in the hall. He shivered like a rabbit. He bore with fortitude her "Wait till I get you home, your folks are out of their minds worrying," was quite calm during "That's all the Harris in you coming out," smiled at her "Reckon you can stay one night," and returned the hug at long last bestowed upon him. Atticus pushed up his glasses and rubbed his face. "Your father's tired," said Aunt Alexandra, her first words in hours, it seemed. She had been there, but I suppose struck dumb most of the time. "You children get to bed now." We left them in the dining room, Atticus still mopping his face. "From rape to riot to runaways," we heard him chuckle. "I wonder what the next 2 hours will bring." Since things appeared to have worked out pretty well, Dill and I decided to be civil to Jem. Besides, Dill had to sleep with him, so we might as well speak to him. I put on my pajamas, read for a while, and found myself suddenly unable to keep my eyes open. Dill and Jem were quiet. When I turned off my reading lamp, there was no strip of light under the door to Jem's room. I must have slept a long time, for when I was punched awake, the room was dim with the light of the setting moon. "Move over, Scout." "He thought he had to," I mumbled. "Don't stay mad with him." Dill got in bed beside me.
"I ain't," he said. "I just wanted to sleep with you. Are you waked up?"
By this time I was, but lazily so.
"Why'd you do it?"
No answer.
I said, "Why'd you run off? Was he really hateful like you said?"
"No."
"Didn't you all build that boat like you wrote you were gonna?"
"He just said we would. We never did." I raised up on my elbow, facing Dill's outline.
"It's no reason to run off. They don't get around to doing what they say they're gonna do half the time."
"That wasn't it.
They just wasn't interested in me."
This was the weirdest reason for flight I had ever heard.
"How come?"
"Well, they stayed gone all the time, and when they were home even, they'd get off in a room by themselves."
"What'd they do in there?"
"Nothing, just sitting and reading, but they didn't want me with them." I pushed the pillow to the headboard and sat up.
"You know something? I was fixing to run off tonight because there they all were. You don't want them around you all the time, Dill."
Dill breathed his patient breath, a half sigh.
"Good night. Atticus is gone all day and sometimes half the night, and off in the legislature, and I don't know what. You don't want 'em around all the time, Dill. You couldn't do anything if they were.
That's not it.
As Dill explained, I found myself wondering what life would be if Jem were different, even from what he was now. What would I do if Atticus did not feel the necessity of my presence, help, and advice? Why, he couldn't get along a day without me. Even Calpurnia couldn't get along unless I was there. They needed me.
Dill, you ain't telling me right. Your folks couldn't do without you. They must be just mean to you. Tell you what to do about that.
Dill's voice went on steadily in the darkness. The thing is, what I'm trying to say is, they do get on a lot better without me. I can't help them any. They ain't mean. They buy me everything I want. But it's, now you've got it, go play with it. You've got a room full of things. I got you that book, so go read it. Dill tried to deepen his voice. You're not a boy. Boys get out and play baseball with other boys. They don't hang around the house worrying their folks.
Dill's voice was his own again.
Oh, they ain't mean. They kiss you and hug you good night and good morning and goodbye and tell you they love you.
Scout, let's get us a baby.
Where?
There was a man Dill had heard of who had a boat that he rowed across to a foggy island where all these babies were.
You could order one.
That's a lie.
Artie said God drops them down the chimney. At least, that's what I think she said.
For once, Auntie's diction had not been too clear.
Well, it ain't so. You get babies from each other. But there's this man, too. He has all these babies just waiting to wake up. He breathes life into 'em.
Dill was off again. Beautiful things floated around in his dreamy head. He could read 2 books to my 1, but he preferred the magic of his own inventions. He could add and subtract faster than lightning, but he preferred his own twilight world, a world where babies slept, waiting to be gathered like morning lilies. He was slowly talking himself to sleep and taking me with him, but in the quietness of his foggy island there rose the faded image of a gray house with sad brown doors.
Dill? Why do you reckon Boo Radley's never run off?
Dill sighed a long sigh and turned away from me.
Maybe he doesn't have anywhere to run off to.
Chapter 15. After many telephone calls, much pleading on behalf of the defendant, and a long, forgiving letter from his mother, it was decided that Dill could stay. We had a week of peace together. After that, little, it seemed. A nightmare was upon us. It began one evening after supper. Dill was over. Aunt Alexandra was in her chair in the corner. Atticus was in his. Jem and I were on the floor reading. It had been a placid week. I had minded Auntie. Jem had outgrown the treehouse, but helped Dill and me construct a new rope ladder for it. Dill had hit upon a foolproof plan to make Boo Radley come out at no cost to ourselves. Place a trail of lemon drops from the back door to the front yard, and he'd follow it, like an ant. There was a knock on the front door. Jem answered it, and said it was Mr. Heck Tate.
"Well, ask him to come in," said Atticus.
"I already did. There's some men outside in the yard. They want you to come out."
In Macomb, grown men stood outside in the front yard for only 2 reasons, death and politics. I wondered who had died. Jem and I went to the front door, but Atticus called, "Go back in the house." Jem turned out the living room lights and pressed his nose to a window screen. Aunt Alexandra protested. "Just for a second, Auntie. Let's see who it is," he said. Dill and I took another window. A crowd of men was standing around Atticus. They all seemed to be talking at once.
"Moving him to the county jail tomorrow," Mr. Tate was saying. "I don't look for any trouble, but I can't guarantee there won't be any."
"Don't be foolish, Heck," Atticus said. "This is Macomb."
"Said I was just uneasy."
"Heck, we've gotten one postponement of this case, just to make sure there's nothing to be uneasy about."
"This is Saturday," Atticus said. "Trial will probably be Monday. You can keep him one night, can't you?"
"I don't think anybody in Macomb will begrudge me a client, with times this hard."
There was a murmur of glee that died suddenly when Mr. Link Dias said,
"Nobody around here's up to anything. It's that old Sarum bunch I'm worried about. Can't you get a... what is it, Heck?"
"Change of venue," said Mr. Tate.
"Not much point in that, now is it?"
Atticus said something inaudible. I turned to Jem, who waved me to silence.
"Besides," Atticus was saying, "you're not scared of that crowd, are you? Know how they do when they get shinnied up."
"They don't usually drink on Sunday. They go to church most of the day," Atticus said.
"This is a special occasion, though," someone said.
They murmured and buzzed until Auntie said if Jem didn't turn on the living room lights, he would disgrace the family. Jem didn't hear her.
"Don't see why you touched it in the first place," Mr. Link Dias was saying. "You've got everything to lose from this, Atticus. I mean everything."
"Do you really think so?"
This was Atticus's dangerous question.
"Do you really think you want to move there, Scout?"
Bam, 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 and the checkerboard was swept clean of my men.
"Do you really think that, son? Then read this."
Jem would struggle the rest of an evening through the speeches of Henry W. Grady.
"Link, that boy might go to the chair, but he's not going till the truth's told."
Atticus's voice was even.
"And you know what the truth is."
There was a murmur among the group of men, made more ominous when Atticus moved back to the bottom front step and the men drew nearer to him. Suddenly, Jem screamed, "Atticus, the telephone's ringing!" The men jumped a little and scattered. They were people we saw every day. Merchants, in-town farmers. Dr. Reynolds was there. So was Mr. Avery.
"Well, answer it, son," called Atticus.
Laughter broke them up. When Atticus switched on the overhead light in the living room, he found Jem at the window, pale, except for the vivid mark of the screen on his nose.
"Why on earth are you all sitting in the dark?" he asked.
Jem watched him go to his chair and pick up the evening paper. I sometimes think Atticus subjected every crisis of his life to tranquil evaluation behind the Mobile Register, the Birmingham News, and the Montgomery Advertiser. "They were after you, weren't they?" Jem went to him. "They wanted to get you, didn't they?" Atticus lowered the paper and gazed at Jem.
"What have you been reading?" he asked.
Then he said gently, "No, son, those were our friends."
"It wasn't a gang?" Jem was looking from the corners of his eyes. Atticus tried to stifle a smile, but didn't make it.
"No, we don't have mobs and that nonsense in Macomb. I've never heard of a gang in Macomb.
Ku Klux got after some Catholics one time. "Never heard of any Catholics in Macomb either," said Atticus. "You're confusing that with something else. Way back about 1920, there was a Klan, but it was a political organization more than anything. Besides, they couldn't find anybody to scare. They paraded by Mr. Sam Levy's house one night, but Sam just stood on his porch and told 'em things had come to a pretty pass. He had sold 'em the very sheets on their backs. Sam made 'em so ashamed of themselves they went away. The Levy family met all criteria for being fine folks. They did the best they could with the sense they had, and they had been living on the same plot of ground in Macomb for 5 generations. "The Ku Klux is gone," said Atticus. "It'll never come back." I walked home with Dill and returned in time to overhear Atticus saying to Auntie, "In favor of Southern womanhood as much as anybody, but not for preserving polite fiction at the expense of human life." A pronouncement that made me suspect they had been fussing again. I sought Jem and found him in his room, on the bed, deep in thought. "Have they been at it?" I asked. "Sort of. She won't let him alone about Tom Robinson. She almost said Atticus was disgracing the family. Scout, I'm scared."
"Scared of what?"
"Scared about Atticus. Somebody might hurt him." Jem preferred to remain mysterious. All he would say to my questions was, "Go on and leave him alone." Next day was Sunday. In the interval between Sunday school and church, when the congregation stretched its legs, I saw Atticus standing in the yard with another knot of men. Mr. Heck Tate was present, and I wondered if he had seen the light. He never went to church. Even Mr. Underwood was there. Mr. Underwood had no use for any organization but the Macomb Tribune, of which he was the sole owner, editor, and printer. His days were spent at his linotype, where he refreshed himself occasionally from an ever-present gallon jug of cherry wine. He rarely gathered news. People brought it to him. It was said that he made up every edition of the Macomb Tribune out of his own head and wrote it down on the linotype. This was believable. Something must have been up to haul Mr. Underwood out. I caught Atticus coming in the door, and he said that they'd moved Tom Robinson to the Macomb jail. He also said, more to himself than to me, that if they'd kept him there in the first place, there wouldn't have been any fuss. I watched him take his seat on the third row from the front, and I heard him rumble, "Nearer, my God, to thee," some notes behind the rest of us. He never sat with Auntie, Jem, and me. He liked to be by himself in church. The fake peace that prevailed on Sundays was made more irritating by Aunt Alexandra's presence. Atticus would flee to his office directly after dinner, where, if we sometimes looked in on him, we would find him sitting back in his swivel chair reading. Aunt Alexandra composed herself for a 2-hour nap and dared us to make any noise in the yard. The neighborhood was resting. Jem, in his old age, had taken to his room with a stack of football magazines. So Dill and I spent our Sundays creeping around in deer's pasture. Shooting on Sundays was prohibited, so Dill and I kicked Jem's football around the pasture for a while, which was no fun. Dill asked if I'd like to have a poke at Boo Radley. I said I didn't think it'd be nice to bother him, and spent the rest of the afternoon filling Dill in on last winter's events. He was considerably impressed. We parted at supper time, and after our meal, Jem and I were settling down to a routine evening when Atticus did something that interested us. He came into the living room carrying a long electrical extension cord. There was a light bulb on the end. "I'm going out for a while," he said. "You folks will be in bed when I come back.
so I'll say good night now." With that, he put his hat on and went out the back door.
"He's taken the car," said Jem.
Our father had a few peculiarities. One was he never ate desserts. Another was that he liked to walk. As far back as I could remember, there was always a Chevrolet in excellent condition in the car house, and Atticus put many miles on it in business trips. But in Macomb, he walked to and from his office 4 times a day, covering about 2 miles. He said his only exercise was walking. In Macomb, if one went for a walk with no definite purpose in mind, it was correct to believe one's mind incapable of definite purpose. Later on, I bade my aunt and brother good night and was well into a book when I heard Jem rattling around in his room. His go-to-bed noises were so familiar to me that I knocked on his door.
"Why ain't you going to bed?"
"I'm going downtown for a while." He was changing his pants.
"Why? It's almost 10 o'clock, Jem."
He knew it, but he was going anyway.
"Then I'm going with you. If you say no, you're not, I'm going anyway, hear?"
Jem saw that he would have to fight me to keep me home, and I suppose he thought a fight would antagonize Auntie, so he gave in with little grace. I dressed quickly. We waited until Auntie's light went out, and we walked quietly down the back steps. There was no moon tonight.
"Dill'll want to come," I whispered.
"So he will," said Jem gloomily. We leaped over the driveway wall, cut through Miss Rachel's side yard, and went to Dill's window. Jem whistled Bob White. Dill's face appeared at the screen, disappeared, and 5 minutes later he unhooked the screen and crawled out. An old campaigner, he did not speak until we were on the sidewalk.
"What's up?"
"Jem's got the look-arounds,"
an affliction Calpurnia said all boys caught at his age.
"I've just got this feeling," Jem said. "Just this feeling."
We went by Mrs. DeBose's house, standing empty and shuttered, her camellias grown up in weeds and Johnson grass. There were 8 more houses to the post office corner. The south side of the square was deserted. Giant monkey puzzle bushes bristled on each corner, and between them an iron hitching rail glistened under the street lights. A light shone in the county toilet. Otherwise, that side of the courthouse was dark. A larger square of stores surrounded the courthouse square. Dim lights burned from deep within them. Atticus's office was in the courthouse when he began his law practice, but after several years of it he moved to quieter quarters in the Macomb Bank building. When we rounded the corner of the square, we saw the car parked in front of the bank.
"He's in there," said Jem.
But he wasn't. His office was reached by a long hallway. Looking down the hall, we should have seen Atticus Finch, attorney at law, in small, sober letters against the light from behind his door. It was dark. Jem peered in the bank door to make sure. He turned the knob. The door was locked.
"Let's go up the street. Maybe he's visiting Mr. Underwood."
Mr. Underwood not only ran the Macomb Tribune office, he lived in it. That is, above it. He covered the courthouse and jailhouse news simply by looking out his upstairs window. The office building was on the northwest corner of the square, and to reach it we had to pass the jail. The Macomb jail was the most venerable and hideous of the county's buildings. Atticus said it was like something Cousin Joshua St. Clair might have designed. It was certainly someone's dream. Starkly out of place, in a town of square-faced stores and steep-roofed houses, the Macomb jail was a miniature Gothic joke, 1 cell wide and 2 cells high, complete with tiny battlements and flying buttresses. Its fantasy was heightened by its red brick facade and the thick steel bars at its ecclesiastical windows. It stood on no lonely hill,
but was wedged between Tyndall's hardware store and the Macomb Tribune office. The jail was Macomb's only conversation piece. Its detractors said it looked like a Victorian privy. Its supporters said it gave the town a good, solid, respectable look, and no stranger would ever suspect that it was full of niggers. As we walked up the sidewalk, we saw a solitary light burning in the distance. "That's funny," said Jem. "Jail doesn't have an outside light."
"Looks like it's over the door," said Dill.
A long extension cord ran between the bars of a second-floor window and down the side of the building. In the light from its bare bulb, Atticus was sitting propped against the front door. He was sitting in one of his office chairs, and he was reading, oblivious of the night bugs dancing over his head. I made to run, but Jem caught me. "Don't go to him," he said. "He might not like it." "He's all right. Let's go home. I just wanted to see where he was." We were taking a shortcut across the square when four dusty cars came in from the Meridian Highway, moving slowly in a line. They went around the square, past the bank building, and stopped in front of the jail. Nobody got out. We saw Atticus look up from his newspaper. He closed it, folded it deliberately, dropped it in his lap, and pushed his hat to the back of his head. He seemed to be expecting them.
"Come on," whispered Jem.
We streaked across the square, across the street, until we were in the shelter of the Jitney Jungle door. Jem peeked up the sidewalk.
"We can get closer," he said.
We ran to Tyndall's hardware door, near enough, at the same time discreet. In ones and twos, men got out of the cars. Shadows became substance as lights revealed solid shapes moving toward the jail door. Atticus remained where he was. The men hid him from view.
"He in there, Mr. Finch?" a man said.
"He is," we heard Atticus answer, "and he's asleep. Don't wake him up." In obedience to my father, there followed what I later realized was a sickeningly comic aspect of an unfunny situation. The men talked in near whispers.
"You know what we want," another man said. "Get aside from that door, Mr. Finch."
"You can turn around and go home again, Walter," Atticus said, pleasantly. "Heck Tate's around somewhere."
"The hell he is," said another man.
"Heck's bunch is so deep in the woods, they won't get out till morning."
"Indeed? Why so?"
"Called 'em off on a snipe hunt," was the succinct answer. "Didn't you think of that, Mr. Finch?"
"Thought about it, but didn't believe it." "Well, then," my father's voice was still the same, "that changes things, doesn't it?"
"It do,"
another deep voice said. Its owner was a shadow.
"Do you really think so?"
This was the second time I heard Atticus ask that question in 2 days, and it meant somebody's man would get jumped. This was too good to miss. I broke away from Jem and ran as fast as I could to Atticus. Jem shrieked and tried to catch me, but I had a lead on him and Dill. I pushed my way through dark, smelly bodies and burst into the circle of light.
"Hey, Atticus!"
I thought he would have a fine surprise, but his face killed my joy. A flash of plain fear was going out of his eyes, but returned when Dill and Jem wriggled into the light. There was a smell of stale whiskey and pig pen about, and when I glanced around, I discovered that these men were strangers. They were not the people I saw last night. Hot embarrassment shot through me. I had leaped triumphantly into a ring of people I had never seen before. Atticus got up from his chair, but he was moving slowly,
like an old man. He put the newspaper down very carefully, adjusting its creases with lingering fingers. They were trembling a little. "Go home, Jem," he said. "Take Scout and Dill home." We were accustomed to prompt, if not always cheerful, acquiescence to Atticus's instructions. But from the way he stood, Jem was not thinking of budging. "Go home," I said. Jem shook his head. As Atticus's fists went to his hips, so did Jem's. And as they faced each other, I could see little resemblance between them. Jem's soft brown hair and eyes, his oval face and snug-fitting ears were our mother's, contrasting oddly with Atticus's graying black hair and square-cut features. But they were somehow alike. Mutual defiance made them alike. "Son, I said go home." Jem shook his head. "I'll send him home," a burly man said, and grabbed Jem roughly by the collar. He yanked Jem nearly off his feet. "Don't you touch him!" I kicked the man swiftly. Barefooted, I was surprised to see him fall back in real pain. I intended to kick his shin, but aimed too high. "That'll do, Scout." Atticus put his hand on my shoulder. "Don't kick folks." "No," he said, as I was pleading justification. "Ain't nobody gonna do Jem that way," I said.
"All right, Mr. Finch, get 'em out of here,"
someone growled.
"You got 15 seconds to get 'em out of here."
In the midst of this strange assembly, Atticus stood trying to make Jem mind him. "I ain't going," was his steady answer to Atticus's threats, requests, and finally, "Please, Jem, take them home." I was getting a bit tired of that, but felt Jem had his own reasons for doing as he did, in view of his prospects, once Atticus did get him home. I looked around the crowd. It was a summer's night, but the men were dressed, most of them, in overalls and denim shirts buttoned up to the collars. I thought they must be cold-natured, as their sleeves were unrolled and buttoned at the cuffs. Some wore hats pulled firmly down over their ears. They were sullen-looking, sleepy-eyed men who seemed unused to late hours. I sought once more for a familiar face, and at the center of the semicircle I found one. "Hey, Mr. Cunningham!" The man did not hear me, it seemed. "Hey, Mr. Cunningham! How's your entailment getting along?" Mr. Walter Cunningham's legal affairs were well known to me. Atticus had once described them at length. The big man blinked and hooked his thumbs in his overall straps. He seemed uncomfortable. He cleared his throat and looked away. My friendly overture had fallen flat. Mr. Cunningham wore no hat, and the top half of his forehead was white in contrast to his sun-scorched face, which led me to believe that he wore one most days. He shifted his feet, clad in heavy work shoes.
"Don't you remember me, Mr. Cunningham? I'm Jean Louise Finch. You brought us some hickory nuts one time, remember?"
I began to sense the futility one feels when unacknowledged by a chance acquaintance.
"I go to school with Walter," I began again. "He's your boy, ain't he? Ain't he, sir?"
Mr. Cunningham was moved to a faint nod.
"He did know me, after all." "He's in my grade," I said, "and he does right well." "He's a good boy," I added, "a real nice boy. We brought him home for dinner one time. Maybe he told you about me? I beat him up one time, but he was real nice about it. Tell him hey for me, won't you?"
Atticus had said it was the polite thing to talk to people about what they were interested in, not about what you were interested in. Mr. Cunningham displayed no interest in his son, so I tackled his entailment once more as a last-ditch effort to make him feel at home. "Entailments are bad," I was advising him, when I slowly awoke to the fact that I was addressing the entire aggregation. The men were all looking at me. Some had their mouths half open. Atticus had stopped poking at Jem. They were standing together beside Dill. Their attention amounted to fascination. Atticus's mouth, even, was half open, an attitude he had once described as uncouth. Our eyes met, and he shut it. "Well, Atticus, I was just saying to Mr. Cunningham that entailments are bad and all that, but you said not to worry. It takes a long time sometimes, that you all would ride it out together." I was slowly drying up, wondering what idiocy I had committed. Entailments seemed all right enough for living room talk. I began to feel sweat gathering at the edges of my hair. I could stand anything but a bunch of people looking at me. They were quite still. "What's the matter?" I said. Atticus said nothing. I looked around and up at Mr. Cunningham, whose face was equally impassive. Then he did a peculiar thing. He squatted down and took me by both shoulders. "I'll tell him you said hey, little lady," he said. Then he straightened up and waved a big paw. "Let's clear out," he called. "Let's get going, boys." As they had come, in ones and twos, the men shuffled back to their ramshackle cars. Doors slammed, engines coughed, and they were gone. I turned to Atticus, but Atticus had gone to the jail and was leaning against it with his face to the wall. I went to him and pulled his sleeve. "Can we go home now?" He nodded, produced his handkerchief, gave his face a going over, and blew his nose violently. "Mr. Finch?" A soft, husky voice came from the darkness above. "They gone?" Atticus stepped back and looked up. "They've gone," he said. "Get some sleep, Tom. They won't bother you any more." From a different direction, another voice cut crisply through the night. "You're damn tootin' they won't. Had you covered all the time, Atticus." Mr. Underwood and a double-barreled shotgun were leaning out his window above the Macomb Tribune office. It was long past my bedtime, and I was growing quite tired. It seemed that Atticus and Mr. Underwood would talk for the rest of the night, Mr. Underwood out the window and Atticus up at him. Finally, Atticus returned, switched off the light above the jail door, and picked up his chair. "Can I carry it for you, Mr. Finch?" asked Dill. He had not said a word the whole time. "Why, thank you, son." Walking toward the office, Dill and I fell into step behind Atticus and Jem. Dill was encumbered by the chair, and his pace was slower. Atticus and Jem were well ahead of us, and I assumed that Atticus was giving him hell for not going home. But I was wrong. As they passed under a streetlight, Atticus reached out and massaged Jem's hair, his one gesture of affection. Chapter 16. Jem heard me. He thrust his head around the connecting door. As he came to my bed, Atticus's light flashed on. We stayed where we were until it went off. We heard him turn over, and we waited until he was still again. Jem took me to his room and put me in bed beside him. "Try to go to sleep," he said. "It'll be all over after tomorrow, maybe." We had come in quietly, so as not to wake Auntie. Atticus killed the engine in the driveway and coasted to the car house. We went in the back door and to our rooms without a word. I was very tired and was drifting into sleep when the memory of Atticus calmly folding his newspaper and pushing back his hat became Atticus standing in the middle of an empty, waiting street, pushing up his glasses. The full meaning of the night's events hit me, and I began crying. Jem was awfully nice about it. For once he didn't remind me that people nearly 9 years old didn't do things like that. Everybody's appetite was delicate this morning, except Jem's. He ate his way through 3 eggs. Atticus watched in frank admiration. Aunt Alexandra sipped coffee and radiated waves of disapproval. Children who slipped out at night were a disgrace to the family. Atticus said he was right glad his disgraces had come along. But Auntie said, "Nonsense. Mr. Underwood was there all the time." "You know, it's a funny thing about Braxton," said Atticus. "He despises Negroes. Won't have one near him." Local opinion held Mr. Underwood to be an intense, profane little man, whose father, in a fey fit of humor, christened Braxton Bragg, a name Mr. Underwood had done his best to live down. Atticus said naming people after Confederate generals made slow, steady drinkers. Calpurnia was serving Aunt Alexandra more coffee, and she shook her head at what I thought was a pleading, winning look. "You're still too little," she said. "I'll tell you when you ain't." I said it might help my stomach. "All right," she said, and got a cup from the sideboard. She poured one tablespoonful of coffee into it and filled the cup to the brim with milk. I thanked her by sticking out my tongue at it and looked up to catch Auntie's warning frown. But she was frowning at Atticus. She waited until Calpurnia was in the kitchen. Then she said, "Don't talk like that in front of them." "Talk like what in front of whom?" he asked. "Like that in front of Calpurnia. You said Braxton Underwood despises Negroes right in front of her." "Well, I'm sure Cal knows it. Everybody in Macomb knows it." I was beginning to notice a subtle change in my father these days that came out when he talked with Aunt Alexandra. It was a quiet digging in, never outright irritation. There was a faint starchiness in his voice when he said, "Anything fit to say at the table's fit to say in front of Calpurnia. She knows what she means to this family." "I don't think it's a good habit, Atticus. It encourages them. You know how they talk among themselves. Everything that happens in this town's out to the quarters before sundown." My father put down his knife. "I don't know of any law that says they can't talk. Maybe if we didn't give them so much to talk about, they'd be quiet. Why don't you drink your coffee, Scout?" I was playing in it with the spoon. "I thought Mr. Cunningham was a friend of ours. You told me a long time ago he was."
"He still is."
"But last night he wanted to hurt you."
Atticus placed his fork beside his knife and pushed his plate aside. "Mr. Cunningham's basically a good man," he said. "He just has his blind spots, along with the rest of us."
Jem spoke. "Don't call that a blind spot. He'd have killed you last night when he first went there."
"He might have hurt me a little," Atticus conceded. "But, son, you'll understand folks a little better when you're older. A mob's always made up of people, no matter what."
"Mr. Cunningham was part of a mob last night, but he was still a man. Every mob in every little southern town is always made up of people you know. Doesn't say much for them, does it?"
"I'll say not," said Jem.
"So it took an 8-year-old child to bring 'em to their senses, didn't it?" said Atticus. "That proves something, that a gang of wild animals can be stopped simply because they're still human."
"Maybe we need a police force of children."
You children last night made Walter Cunningham stand in my shoes for a minute. That was enough. Well, I hoped Jim would understand folks a little better when he was older. I wouldn't. First day Walter comes back to school will be his last, I affirmed. You will not touch him, Atticus said flatly. I don't want either of you bearing a grudge about this thing, no matter what happens. You see, don't you, said Aunt Alexandra, what comes of things like this? Don't say I haven't told you. Atticus said he'd never say that, pushed out his chair, and got up. There's a day ahead, so excuse me. Jem, I don't want you and Scout downtown today, please. As Atticus departed, Dill came bounding down the hall into the dining room. It's all over town this morning, he announced, all about how we held off 100 folks with our bare hands. Aunt Alexandra stared him to silence. It was not 100 folks, she said, and nobody held anybody off. It was just a nest of those Cunninghams, drunk and disorderly. Oh, Auntie, that's just Dill's way, said Jem. He signaled us to follow him. You all stay in the yard today, she said, as we made our way to the front porch. It was like Saturday. People from the south end of the county passed our house in a leisurely but steady stream. Mr. Dolphus Raymond lurched by on his thoroughbred. Don't see how he stays in the saddle, murmured Jem. How can you stand to get drunk before 8 in the morning? A wagon load of ladies rattled past us. They wore cotton sunbonnets and dresses with long sleeves. A bearded man in a wool hat drove them. Yonder's some Mennonites, Jem said to Dill. They don't have buttons. They lived deep in the woods, did most of their trading across the river, and rarely came to make 'em. Dill was interested. They've all got blue eyes, Jem explained, and the men can't shave after they marry. Their wives like for 'em to tickle 'em with their beards. Mr. X. Billups rode by on a mule and waved to us. He's a funny man, said Jem. X is his name, not his initial. He was in court one time, and they asked him his name. He said, X. Billups. Clerk asked him to spell it, and he said, X. Asked him again, and he said, X. They kept at it till he wrote X on a sheet of paper and held it up for everybody to see. They asked him where he got his name, and he said that's the way his folks signed him up when he was born. As the county went by us, Jem gave Dill the histories and general attitudes of the more prominent figures. Mr. Tensaw Jones voted the straight prohibition ticket. Miss Emily Davis dipped snuff in private. Mr. Byron Waller could play the violin. Mr. Jake Slade was cutting his third set of teeth. A wagon load of unusually stern-faced citizens appeared. When they pointed to Miss Maudie Atkinson's yard, ablaze with summer flowers, Miss Maudie herself came out on the porch. There was an odd thing about Miss Maudie. On her porch, she was too far away for us to see her features clearly, but we could always catch her mood by the way she stood. She was now standing arms akimbo, her shoulders drooping a little, her head cocked to one side, her glasses winking in the sunlight. We knew she wore a grin of the uttermost wickedness. The driver of the wagon slowed down his mules, and a shrill-voiced woman called out, "He that cometh in vanity departeth in darkness." Miss Maudie answered, "A merry heart maketh a cheerful countenance." I guess that the foot washers thought that the devil was quoting scripture for his own purposes, as the driver speeded his mules. Why they objected to Miss Maudie's yard was a mystery, heightened in my mind, because for someone who spent all the daylight hours outdoors, Miss Maudie's command of scripture was formidable. "You going to court this morning?" asked Jem. We had strolled over. "I am not," she said. I have no business with the court this morning.
Aren't you going down to watch?
Asked Dill. I am not. It's morbid, watching a poor devil on trial for his life. Look at all those folks. It's like a Roman carnival.
They have to try him in public, Miss Morty, I said. Wouldn't be right if they didn't.
I'm quite aware of that, she said. Just because it's public, I don't have to go, do I?
Miss Stephanie Crawford came by. She wore a hat and gloves.
Mm-mm-mm,
she said. Look at all those folks. You'd think William Jennings Bryan was speaking.
And where are you going, Stephanie? Inquired Miss Morty.
To the Jitney Jungle.
Miss Morty said she'd never seen Miss Stephanie go to the Jitney Jungle in a hat in her life.
Well, said Miss Stephanie, I thought I might just look in at the courthouse to see what Atticus is up to.
Better be careful he doesn't hand you a subpoena.
We asked Miss Morty to elucidate. She said Miss Stephanie seemed to know so much about the case, she might as well be called on to testify.
We held off until noon, when Atticus came home to dinner and said they'd spent the morning picking the jury. After dinner, we stopped by for Dill and went to town.
This ends Disc 6, To Kill a Mockingbird, Disc 7.
It was a gala occasion. There was no room at the public hitching rail for another animal. Mules and wagons were parked under every available tree. The courthouse square was covered with picnic parties sitting on newspapers, washing down biscuit and syrup with warm milk from fruit jars. Some people were gnawing on cold chicken and cold fried pork chops. The more affluent chased their food with drugstore Coca-Cola in bulb-shaped soda glasses. Greasy-faced children popped the whip through the crowd, and babies lunched at their mothers' breasts. In a far corner of the square, the Negroes sat quietly in the sun, dining on sardines, crackers, and the more vivid flavors of knee-high cola. Mr. Dolphus Raymond sat with them.
Jim, said Dill, he's drinking out of a sack.
Mr. Dolphus Raymond seemed to be so doing. Two yellow drugstore straws ran from his mouth to the depths of a brown paper bag.
He never seen anybody do that, murmured Dill. How does he keep what's in it in it?
Jem giggled. He's got a Coca-Cola bottle full of whiskey in there.
That so's not to upset the ladies. You'll see him sip it all afternoon. He'll step out for a while and fill it back up. Why's he sitting with the colored folks?
Always does.
He likes 'em better'n he likes us, I reckon. Lives by himself way down near the county line. He's got a colored woman and all sorts of mixed chillen. Show you some of 'em if we see 'em.
He doesn't look like trash, said Dill. He's not. He owns all one side of the river bank down there, and he's from a real old family to boot.
Then why does he do like that?
That's just his way, said Jem.
They say he never got over his wedding. He was supposed to marry one of the Spender ladies, I think. They were going to have a huge wedding, but they didn't. After the rehearsal, the bride went upstairs and blew her head off. Shotgun. She pulled the trigger with her toes.
Did they ever know why?
No, said Jem. Nobody ever knew quite why but Mr. Dolphus. They said it was because she found out about his colored woman. He reckoned he could keep her and get married, too. He's been sort of drunk ever since. You know, though, he's real good to those chillen.
Jem, I asked, what's a mixed child?
Half white, half colored. You've seen 'em, Scout. You know that red, kinky-headed one that delivers for the drugstore. He's half white.
They're real sad.
Sad? How come? They don't belong anywhere. Colored folks won't have 'em because they're half white. White folks won't have 'em because they're colored. So they're just in-betweens. Don't belong anywhere.
But Mr. Dollfuss, now, they say he